Welcome to Break It Down, Eiffel Science's weekly podcast where we discuss the biggest and the most interesting science news stories from the last 7 days. I'm Eleanor Higgs, digital content creator, and this week I'm joined by...
I'm Charlie Haig, the marketing coordinator.
And we have lots of new and exciting science news to discuss, so let's get started. Break It Down. So I'm going to kick us off this week. And I wrote this story, so I should know lots about it. This is the sperm whale phonetic alphabet. And they've been doing lots of research and found that it's surprisingly similar in structure to human language. But before you go getting all excited, thinking you're going to have a conversation with a sperm whale, this is really about the structure of the language, not the meaning. So sperm whales are very social. They live in pods of about 15, 20 individuals. And they communicate by lots of clicks. You might have heard recordings of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And these clicks are called coders. And they've been looking really intently at the structure of these coders and how they're arranged. And they found that the coders can be combined in lots of different ways. And they've like classified them slightly with the musical concepts of rubato, ornamentation, and rhythm and tempo. And they found that these whales can combine all these different ways of doing their coders and make loads and loads of different sounds which are distinguishable, so they've like seen set patterns that come up quite often, and this has helped them develop what they've called the sperm whale phonetic alphabet. So all these clicks can be like combined in lots of different ways to like be chatty.
You say no, that means no speaking to whales. Why It sounds exactly like we can speak to whales. Feels like we're halfway there.
Well, I personally feel like it's a big step in speaking to whales.
Yeah.
But the team were a bit cagey. They said that it's mainly about the classification of the like structure of the language.
Okay.
So I sent some questions to the lead author, Dr. Shane Giro, and he said that the combinational system that we document in sperm whales opens up the possibility that sperm whale's communication might provide our first example of duality patterning in another species outside of humans. The phenomenon that small meaningless parts can be combined into meaningful wholes, which could then be combined into meaningful utterances like sentences. So we're like, we've got to take it back quite a few steps first.
We're so naive in thinking that we're the only ones that have any kind of complex language, but obviously there must be thousands of species that can speak like we do, and having whole conversations that we're not aware of. So cool.
Yeah, it's so cool. And they said that the coders are either generated, like the clicks are, one whale does the click and then the other whale responds with lots of clicks, like turn-taking, like a conversation, or they just all like simultaneously click at the same time with loads of overlapping coders.
That's so cute. Which,
they're just like all your friends like going to a big meal out and everyone's talking all at once.
Yeah, my friends tend to shout over each other, so that's very accurate.
So here's a little clip of the coders from the whales that the team recorded. And they said that they can vary the coda length, so it's not random. Like, it is modulated by the whales, like how long each period of clicks is. And they can add extra clicks, which are called ornamentation, or they can change the duration of the clicks, which is rubato. And they think that because of all these features, there's much greater information carrying capacity, like within the codas of what they could possibly be talking to each other about, which is amazing.
And is this just observed in this one clan then?
Yes, yeah, so this was on the Eastern Caribbean clan, which I think they said it was about 60 whales that they got all these recordings from. It's something like 9,000 recordings of whales. Yeah, it was data from 60 whales in the Eastern Caribbean. And I asked him and he said, we haven't yet looked for features in other clans, coder exchanges. But he said, what we have documented here appears to be structures that are likely to be part of the communication system for all sperm whales. He said it might be that one clan makes more like dramatic, or they have different, you know, features that are unique to each clan, but we don't know yet.
Because don't they move around quite a lot, these clans? Like, I didn't imagine that they'd be too localised.
Yeah, well, apparently there was a previous study that found that they had local dialects. So I guess there's an element of like their area, even if it's massive, is still like their area. So
That's really cool. Although maybe they go to a different area and they can't speak the language, kind of like when we go on holiday.
These sperm whales from the Western Caribbean have got no idea what we're saying. Yeah, I think it's so cool. And I did ask him if one day we would be able to talk to sperm whales, but he said we're a ways off. He said we haven't assigned any meaning, but they are planning another study where they can look at behaviour-based context. So like if they do loads of clicks with loads of ornamentation around when they're feeding or socialising, or like a mother and a calf have a different way than like, you know, two adult whales. So lots more to discover, I reckon.
Yes, but really, really cool. Very cool.
What have you got for me for your first story?
Right. I have got a story written by our staff writer, Holly Large, and it is everything you need to know about why AstraZeneca has taken its COVID vaccine off the market. Yeah. So I think obviously all the anti-vaxxers are going to jump on this story and say it's some scandalous, horrific thing, but it's not. It's actually pretty... pretty normal. It's a commercial decision that has been based on a decline in demand and lots of other available vaccine options, which we didn't really have at the beginning of COVID, but now the market is there's no need for this one anymore. Sorry it's not as dramatic as you would hope that it is, but it's still pretty interesting. So the vaccine was approved for use around 3.5 years ago, which is crazy because in my mind COVID was yesterday or is still happening. Yeah,
it's wild, isn't it? It's 2024.
3.5 years ago, so a lifetime ago. It was approved for use. But since then, there's been loads of different strains and variants and the virus keeps mutating. And a lot of other vaccine companies have been keeping up with the mutations and changing their vaccine to fit, kind of like the seasonal flu jab. But AstraZeneca has not been doing that with their vaccine. So their vaccine is for the original, the OG COVID, which...
The OG COVID back in 2020.
Exactly. Isn't much of an issue anymore. So, yeah, it's not as useful as it once was. So there's no point in keeping it in circulation.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Exactly. It's less effective now than it was back in 2020. But yeah, even though it's coming to an end, the AstraZeneca vaccine was, some reports said that it is estimated to have saved over 6.5 million lives just in the first year of its use.
Wow.
So it was definitely a very important vaccine.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember which ones I had. It seems...
Yeah, I can't remember.
Both seems like yesterday and a lifetime ago. I think I had Moderna at one point, but I think that was later down the line.
Yeah, well, AstraZeneca was the one that a lot of countries banned because they were worried about this blood clotting condition called TTS. It was the one that was taken off markets in a lot of countries. But there was studies done on the vaccine, and apparently the risk of vaccine-induced TTSS is only around 4 in every 1 million people. So it was
super low.
Yeah, super low. And also a lot of drugs have you at risk of blood clots. So I don't think it's actually massively more important, more risky than anything else. Another study involving 29 million people looked at the likelihood of developing blood clots from a COVID infection versus the vaccine. And you're more likely to get a blood clot from having COVID than you are from getting the AstraZeneca vaccine. So, yes, it's absolutely not a concern. But regardless, it's not around.
It's
anymore.
Off the market anyway.
It is. But good job, AstraZeneca, for your hard work.
This is cool. This is something I'd never previously considered. So this was written by Stephen Luntz, our freelance writer, and it's all about Earth's magnetic field, which apparently was near collapse 590 million years ago. Which sounds very dramatic, but it's actually a good thing. So in case you didn't know, Earth's magnetic field has changed direction many times over millions of years, which I definitely didn't know.
Yeah, I'm starting to realise I don't actually understand magnetic fields at all. This just seems so complicated to me.
I think it's really interesting, but it is a bit sort of hard to get your head around. So yes, the magnetic field has changed direction many times, which has also sometimes been accompanied by a weakening in the magnetic field. And the researchers reckon that a long period in which the field diminished took place between 591 and 565 million years ago. Shortly thereafter, however, we get the first fossils of complex animals appearing in the geological record. So they think that these things might be interlinked. And the geomagnetic field protects Earth, basically. It protects the atmosphere from being stripped by solar wind, and it acts as a shield against radiation from the sun, from coronal mass ejections. And they think if we're going to look for life beyond the solar system, those planets that potentially could have life probably will also have a powerful magnetic field. And despite all that I've just said about it being important to have a strong one, they think that this weakening means that there would have been more oxygen. So most people believe that complex life started to emerge on Earth because there became more oxygen in the atmosphere, which allowed these animals to develop more complex body plans. And so they think that the weakening would have let more hydrogen escape into the atmosphere. So then there would have been more oxygen.
Yes, so it's kind of counterintuitive, but yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's cool. And you can see the field strength and directions over Earth's history in rocks. And Professor John Tardno of the University of Rochester and his colleagues went to Brazil and they found some crystals which were 591 million years old, and they found evidence for the lowest magnetic field ever recorded, which was 1/30th of modern levels, which I guess is a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying, well, that means nothing to my stupid brain. But I do need to point out the amazing header image on this article. Is that one of the first, what, that freaky thing? I don't even know how to describe that.
It looks like someone's dropped a pale pink fan on the floor.
Yeah, I thought like a toupee that's been run over. That is exactly what it looks like.
Yes, it says that the image caption gets me because it says a weakened geomagnetic field may have been behind this. So you have to head to our website and look at this image. But yes, complex life was still not super complex 591 million years ago.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Yeah, exactly. But they said that, yes, it's quite hard to model because you can't sort of go back in time and see how it would have been. And they don't really know how much more oxygen there would have been compared, but they think it could have been quite a big factor, allowing the fauna to get more complicated. And they also suggest that the protective field could have shrunk so that plasma in the upper atmosphere becomes exposed to solar wind, which would have greatly increased the loss of hydrogen ions. And then because of that, increased exposure to highly charged particles from the sun would have produced more nitrogen oxides, which create ozone holes, like the one that we made with all the CFS back when, which would then expose the lower atmosphere to extra ultraviolet radiation, which can split water vapor into hydrogen and oxygen. So even more hydrogen would have gone away, so even more oxygen. So it's all sort of linked, that the lower the field, the more exposed Earth atmosphere would have been. So the more hydrogen we would have lost. But then there would have been greater oxygen.
It sounds like a bunch of happy accidents tend to create life in a strange way.
Yeah. It's cool. I definitely would not have considered the changes in the geomagnetic field.
No.
At any point.
But definitely not to kind of create life. That's crazy.
No, yeah. Well, I guess just change the atmosphere to give more oxygen, and then life was sort of ready and waiting there to get more complex and more exciting. So maybe we owe a lot. Maybe we owe our existence to the geomagnetic field. What have you got for me next?
Right. My next one is written by Tom Hale, our senior journalist, and it is about a newly discovered rock art that indicates that the Sahara was a very different place 4,000 years ago. So if you know anything about what I usually write for IFLS, I love rocks and I love deserts and I love rock art. So yeah, this story is right up my street. So there's a site in the Atbai Desert in eastern Sudan that has this prehistoric rock art that implies the surrounding land was once lush green forests filled with water and lots of animals, which obviously it's not like that these days. So that was the original find. And then there's been a subsequent find, which this article is about, 16 rock art desert sites in a city in northern Sudan that were kind of depicting a similar unexpected scene. So it's not massively uncommon to see landscapes kind of change really dramatically over hundreds of thousands of years. I think we see that quite often. But
yeah,
these ones, just 4,000 years ago, which is like nothing in the grand scheme of things. That's like yesterday. It's, yeah, crazy to see such a dramatic change in a landscape in that short of a time. But yeah, these illustrations in northern Sudan, they show pictures of humans, antelopes, giraffes, elephants, and a lot of cattle, which is this area
not
kind of
not so many cows in the Sahara at the
exactly
moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first read this, I was like, elephants and giraffes, that's crazy, because this is like bordering Egypt, so very northern Africa. Yeah, so that was my first thing of kind of the first thing that impressed me about this. But obviously that's actually not that weird. Yeah, they're usually living in desert adjacent environments, so yeah, it's not that uncommon to see them wandering around Africa. But the cattle, they really need a lot of grass, they need a lot of water, they can't survive in a desert at all. So
absolutely not.
Yeah, it's kind of evidence that there was a very dramatic difference in how the area looked then than it is now.
Yeah, from lush green cattle home to
exactly
absolutely massive sand dunes. And I mean, it's a huge area as well, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's yeah,
it's all desert for miles and miles.
So they think what happened is that between 15,000 and 5,000 years ago, Africa had a summer monsoon that covered the entire continent and doused it in loads of rain and birthed all of this green lush life and loads of lakes and rivers, and all these animals kind of came from that and lived there quite happily until the monsoon season ended and everything dried up again, went back to its original state, and everyone had to kind of flee the area and leave all their livestock and all the animal and plants just died, really, or adapted.
So, oh, my word.
Yeah, a little bit sad. But, I mean, it would, I think, very cool to see a lush green desert, what we now know as a desert, to see it in that condition. But deserts are also awesome, so I'm glad we got our deserts.
Yeah, I mean, some of those David Attenborough shows with those cool
species
exactly that adapted to getting moisture out of the atmosphere from their skin, or they lick their eyeballs, or all those sorts of weird things that they do. So yeah, if we didn't have the Sahara,
these harsh environments definitely breed these crazy adaptable animals that are very, very cool. So yes, long live the desert. I don't want it to be green, thank you.
I was just going to say, maybe we could have another giant monsoon and turn it all back lush and fertile, but
for a few years. But then think of all the things that'll die and be displaced when it goes back to being dry. So
No, maybe stick with what we've got. Oh, this is a fun one. This was written by Laura Simmons, our editor and staff writer, and it's all about psychedelic venom from a toad.
Oh, hell yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get much more Eiffel Science than that, really, does it? So this is the Colorado River toad, and he's hit the news before because this is the one that like wildlife officials keep going online and telling people not to go and search out and give it a little lick.
Is this the licking toad? There's not a new one.
This is
something.
The licking.
It's the licking
I'm
toad.
I'm pretty sure it's the same licking toad. There may be more than one, but I'm fairly confident it's the same one. So they have this venom which they secrete through glands on their skin, and it contains a hallucinogenic compound, which is why people go out into the wild and try and lick them. But please don't do that. But scientists have got behind this because they say it could be a new potent antidepressant, which is very exciting. So stuff like psilocybin from magic mushrooms has already been tested. There's lots of growing body of research investigating this sort of compound for hard to treat severe depression cases. But now there's a new psychedelic in town from this toad, and it's called, well, the compound is called 5-MeO-DMT, and it's extracted from the venom of the toad. And they think it could be an effective treatment option for depression and anxiety. And they set about testing it with a type of serotonin receptor called 5-HT1A. Now, normally they do a lot of tests with the receptor 5-HT2A, but they've gone to 1A for this one, but there's not so much research on that. And in mice, they compared it to LSD and existing drugs that target HT1A, and they found that the toad venom had similar antidepressant and anti-anxiety effects, but it didn't get the mice high, everyone. So,
high mice is a hilarious concept. I mean, I don't know how ethical it is, but how would you even tell that a mouse was high? That's.
I'm sure they have a way. Just really chilled out mice.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, yeah, so the mice weren't high, but they did have a similar effect on, like, an antidepressant effect and an anti-anxiety effect. And this compound worked massively better with the 5-H1A receptor compared to 5-H2A. So that's another area of research that we could delve closer into. And obviously they've only tested it in mice, so it might be a little way off seeing if it has the same effect in people. But yeah, very exciting. And imagine being like, oh yeah, I got cured by toad venom.
Exactly.
From my depression and anxiety.
Are we one day going to have just toads in our house at hand, ready for a quick lick if we're feeling a bit down? I don't know. I don't know how much depression that would cure for me, having to lick a toad, but yeah, maybe.
Well, apparently if you just lick the toad, then you get all the hallucinogenic effects. Oh, okay. So definitely don't lick the toads.
Okay,
this is not an invitation to lick the toads. But maybe sometime soon we might have antidepressant medicine made on this compound from toad venom, which would be
very cool. Yeah, as long as they don't have to harm the toads to extract it. I think you can milk them, can't you? Milk their glands, which also doesn't sound very appealing.
Yeah, I don't know how they're extracting this from the toads, but it's secreted through their skin, so maybe they can just do swabs. I honestly am not sure. Yeah, but fascinating, very cool. Go on then, hit me with the last story of the week.
So our feature this week is written by Rachel Funnell, who you all know and love. She has written about, if dinosaurs weren't extinct, would the dinosauroid walk among us? Which is a brilliant title, and paired even better with a hilarious header image that I think Rachel took herself in a museum in the UK. And this thing is just incredible, like a human lizard man who just looks so perplexed and concerned. Yeah, definitely worth checking that image out. So we've got Rachel here to explain a little bit more about this story, so I'll let Rachel expand on this.
Yeah, so this dinosauroid story, it was a chance find, really, because I went to Lyme Regis with my family last week, and there's a fantastic dinosaur land museum there. And you walked around, they've got the fossils, all the things you expect, and then there was this bizarre alien lizard. And I just thought it was sort of like a very 80s like take, but turns out it's actually a thing. So these two guys, was a paleontologist and a model maker, got together and figured, you know, if Chicxulub hadn't come along and killed off all the dinosaurs, where might they have gone? And it begins with the Troodontids, or Truodontids, however you're supposed to say it, which was a carnivorous group of dinosaurs, and they were already bipedal at this point, that kind of classic, like, raptor posture you imagine. And the cascade of changes, it's funny, the thing that actually was quite influential on the guy's, like, design was the story of a two-legged goat. I think it was just born with this birth defect. It didn't have four limbs, so it had to adapt to life strutting around on two legs. And what they saw was that its chest became much flatter, and the, like, anatomy of its pelvis changed, like the musculature and I think how the tendons were and things like that. And so they were like, well, say that these dinosaurs became increasingly bipedal, could we see the same changes there? So whereas, you know, you imagine a dinosaur quite like barrel-chested thing, it could get flatter and look more human, and that would make its head change shape. And so it's one of those things where it looks ridiculous, but there is actually like some consideration that's gone into it. And personally, I wish there was a way we could have found out.
Thanks for that one, Rachel. So this story is, yeah, it kind of makes me feel like we're almost like crabs, how everything is just expected to evolve into a human-like form. But yes, I don't know how true this is or how accurate this one representation is. But yeah, speculative zoology is so much fun and
so much fun.
And I kind of wish it was. I'd like to live in a world with freaky lizard men wandering around. It'd be quite entertaining.
I guess we wouldn't think it was weird. Like, imagine, yeah, it's so strange to imagine what would have happened if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out.
Exactly.
Would we even have evolved in the same way?
Probably yeah, not. I think we definitely would have been hiding a lot more. We would be less bold.
Maybe we'd have had, like, really cool technology. We'd have harnessed the dinosaurs in some way.
I mean, riding a dinosaur would be brilliant. I mean, we've done it with horses, so why not with a dinosaur?
I could tame a triceratops.
Exactly. Yes, Rachel also includes an additional illustration as a link in this article as well, which is a insane looking bird version of this evolution, which was magnificent and worth looking at. I'm so here for this random artwork. I love it so much.
We do love paleo art.
It's so, I mean, is this even paleo art if it's like so speculative? I don't even know how. It's not even nearly accurate what things would actually look like. But yes, this museum, I need to visit this museum. We need to do an IFLS trip to this museum.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Have you got any shout outs for me this week?
Just a small shout out. Rachel mentioned last week, and I think we will continue to mention for the next month, the virtual event, which is a Curious Live. It's completely free. You can grab your tickets we're shouting about it everywhere, but you can grab your tickets on the website. It's going to be a lot of really interesting discussions. It's on the 31st of May. We cover everything from nuclear war to insect detectives. So yes, check it out. There really is something for everyone. It's going to be very fun.
Yeah, can't wait for that. I just have one little shout out. This is a video featuring yours truly and made by our video editor Dom, and it's all about virgin births and parthenogenesis.
Oh, amazing. So cool.
Yeah, which is really cool. I think we talked about before on the podcast Charlotte the Stingray. She makes a little appearance.
What's happened?
I think nothing yet. I think she's still pregnant. We're still waiting with bated breath.
She likes the attention. She's just holding on.
So I think that's probably everything that we have time for, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Break It Down.
Bye.
Break It Down.
Specific links to all the stories in this episode can be found in the episode description or at iflscience.com.